Greetings from the chair, and here is Chairman Henry Hyde.
Mr. Bostarts, we had previously agreed to try to be as timely as possible if we're going to have amendments to let the other side know and have the common decency.
This is Bobby Scott, a Democrat of Virginia.
I have been drafting amendments, but we haven't had, because of the time schedule, the opportunity to caucus to determine which, if any, of those amendments might have actually have support. So I just wanted to notify you that I may have amendments, and we'll get them to you as soon as we possibly can.
The chair would announce that at the conclusion of opening statements, we'll have a 30-minute recess, and you folks can caucus and we can caucus, so that can be more fully discussed.
Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Bob Barr, Republican from Georgia.
Is morning in America, literally and figuratively. Children all across this land are now sitting down in their classes, having been led in the Pledge of Allegiance to our flag by dedicated teachers in classrooms, large and small. Adorning the walls of those classrooms are pictures of great American heroes, such as George Washington. When asked to name the single most important gift America had given the world, Daniel Webster replied, "The integrity of George Washington." How many of us have wondered, as a child, holding a shiny new quarter in our hand, why the profile of George Washington adorns more coin and paper money than any other national figure? Integrity. However, as we stand here today on the threshold of a new millennium, dazed by scandal and riddled with doubt, we are forced to confront the reality that, in the words of Mark Helprin, writing in the July 2nd, 1998, Wall Street Journal, in an essay lamenting the decline of statesmanship, quote, "We have only what we have." When I look out at this audience, Mr. Chairman, I see we all see America. We see Americans young and old, black and white, probably natural born and naturalized, and just as probably rich and poor. Citizens, and likely hopeful citizens, all drawn to America by something that makes generation after generation of boys and girls want to grow up in America. Something that makes citizens of all other lands yearn desperately to come to our shores and become our fellow citizens. What is it that sets us apart, that draws people to America and keeps them here? Anyone who lives in this country, who visits America, quickly learns there is indeed something extraordinarily special about this place. It's something that all of us as Americans feel when we return to our shores from travel abroad. While there are indeed many things that make our nation unique, in the final analysis, everything that is special and unique about our country is built on and protected by one principle, the rule of law. Unfortunately, like many of the phrases in our national debate, the phrase rule of law has been so oft repeated, we risk losing our grasp on exactly what we mean when we say it. What is the rule of law? The rule of law finds its highest and best embodiment in the absolute, unshakable right each one of us has to walk into a courtroom and demand the righting of a wrong. Doesn't matter what color your skin is, what God you pray to, how large your bank account is, or what office you hold. If you are an American citizen, no one should stand between you and your access to justice. President John F. Kennedy put it this way: Americans are free to disagree with the law, but not to disobey it. For a government of laws and not of men, no man, however prominent and powerful, and no mob, however unruly or boisterous, is entitled to defy a court of law. If this country should ever reach the point where any man, or group of men, by force or threat of force, could long defy the commands of our courts and our Constitution, then no law would stand free from doubt. No judge would be sure of his writ, and no citizen would be safe from his neighbors. This, though, is the fundamental American right that President Clinton tried to deny a fellow citizen, Paula Jones. It could just as easily have been anyone here in this room, in the audience, or on the committee. It could have been your husband, your wife, your child, your neighbor. It just happened to be Paula Jones. Whether one agrees with Paula Jones's case or not is irrelevant. What is very relevant is that when she tried to exercise her indisputable right to take her case to the court, the highest official in our nation tried to take that right away from her. That same public official who, as governor, tapped her on the shoulder and had her escorted under the watchful eye of troopers to a hotel room and crassly demanded personal favors of her. Later, when Miss Jones tried to walk into a courtroom, that governor, now the President of the United States of America, slammed the door in her face, and it very nearly remained locked tight. In a society based on justice under law, such an egregious wrong cannot be ignored. We in this Congress, on this committee, absolutely cannot ignore it. Even more troubling is the evidence that this administration has used its power to do exactly the same thing to others. Need we remind America of the 900-plus FBI files brazenly and illegally misused by the White House? Anyone not possessing an infinite capacity for self-delusion knows, whether they're willing to say it or not, that the President perjured himself on multiple occasions and committed other acts of obstruction of justice. It is also glaringly evident he enlisted others, from cabinet officials to political operatives, in this endeavor, and that this endeavor continued into this very room. While reverence for parallels with the Nixon impeachment is seductive but inappropriate, there are some points worth noting. In the Nixon case, for example, lying to Congress and to the American people in just such a manner provoked a separate article of impeachment. Is the danger of such an attack on our constitutional processes any less dangerous today? Sadly, I believe the case we are discussing today is but a small manifestation of President Clinton's utter and complete disregard for the rule of law. Throughout his presidency, his administration has been so successful at thwarting investigations and obstructing the work of Congress and the courts that it may be decades before history reveals the vastness of his abuse of power or the extent of the damage it has wrought. President Clinton apparently subscribes to the same theory Richard Nixon articulated in a 1977 interview with David Frost. Nixon said, when the president does it, that means it is not illegal. That was dead wrong then, and it is dead wrong today. Wrong, that is, unless one subscribes to the principle that the president is not only above the law, but that he is the law. With his conduct and his arrogance, William Jefferson Clinton has thrown a gauntlet at the feet of the Congress. Today, it lies at the base of this very dais. It remains to be seen whether we will pick it up. Throughout our history, there have been other times when the principle of equal justice under law was widely questioned. It happened when some Americans tried to deny other Americans access to justice based on their skin color. It happened when Japanese Americans were imprisoned in barbed wire stockades based on misguided fears. It happened in Watergate, when a president abused his power in an effort to thwart political enemies. However, at each of these critical junctures, Americans, great and small, rose to the occasion. Justice, although sometimes delayed, did prevail. However, in each of these instances, good finally did prevail over evil, the rule of law survived, and we pulled back from the slippery slope, political slope, that is, that ends in tyranny. And in each of these cases, America was guided by the law and the Constitution, not polls or focus groups. You know, as children, all of us believed certain things with all of our hearts. We knew there was a difference between good and evil. We knew it was wrong to lie. And equally important, that if we got caught, we would be punished. We knew that honesty and fairness were as much a part of why we respected our parents, pastors, and teachers, as we assuredly knew they were part of why we pledged allegiance to our flag. What happened to these simple things that we all knew in our hearts just a few short years ago? Why do so many adults now find it so hard to call a lie, when as parents, teachers, and employers, we have no such hesitancy? Why do so many now resist the search for the truth and accountability when we do so day in and day out in our lives at home, in business, in school, and in our religious institutions? In short, in the short time I've served in Congress, I've learned that this place, this city, has an incredible power to complicate the simple. This staggering ability to muddle simple issues is perhaps best illustrated by the fact that much of the president's defense is hinged on defining common words in ways that shock most Americans who think they have a rather firm grasp on the meaning of words, such as lie, alone, is, perjury. But of course, to the president's defenders, words, history, and the records thereof are nothing more than leaves on a sidewalk in the fall, irrelevant items to be swept blithely away when everyone wants to walk from point A to point B. Where does all this leave us? What do we have? Do we have, in Mark Halperin's words, only what we have? I say no. We are not locked in a strange parallel universe in which up is down, is becomes was, and being alone is a physical impossibility. We are not living in an alien world. We are living in America. We are living in an America in which we know that felons are prosecuted and not allowed to remain in office. We live in an America in which rights prevail, wrongs must be righted, and indeed, we have to stand up today, tomorrow, and forever for the rule of law, the Constitution, and accountability, vote articles of impeachment, which are the one tool given us by our founding fathers to do precisely that in precisely this circumstance with precisely this president.
The gentleman's time has expired. The gentlelady from Texas, Ms. Jackson Lee.
Sheila Jackson Lee, a Democrat from Houston.
Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Conyers, first let me thank you for your service to this committee. Fellow colleagues on both the Democratic and Republican side of the aisle, I am here today at this point in history, not to further the political divide, not with a liberal label, a Democratic label, Republican label, or conservative label, because that battle has been fought these last few weeks, and no one has emerged the winner. I come here not angry at my Republican colleagues, but with a heavy heart. I come bearing feelings of somberness and sadness. I am sad not only because of the House is considering articles of impeachment for the President of the United States, but because I recognize that we are doing it without clear and convincing evidence, nor are we using the standard outlined by our framers of the Constitution. The President shall be removed from office on impeachment for conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Ironically, this is a sad moment, yet a historical one. It is sad because Congress has exercised its discretion to draft articles of impeachment which almost equal to, if not greater than, the power to declare war. In 1691, Solicitor General Somers told the British Parliament that the power of impeachment ought to be like Goliath's sword, kept in the temple, and not used but on great occasion. Where do we go from here? Yes, the president did mislead the American people, and he alone must respond to them. However, have the accusations of perjury against the president been proven to warrant impeachment? No. Have the accusations of obstruction of justice against the president to warrant impeachment? No. Have the accusations of abuse of power against the president been proven to warrant impeachment? No. By the response to the above questions, it is obvious that these articles of impeachment are not warranted, nor are they demanded based on what this committee has before it. Impeachment is final and non-appealable. At the very outset, however, let me apologize to the nation for being a party to a proceeding which has allowed an investigation to absorb the time and energies of this Congress. I know my fellow Americans across the nation hope that we will be able to quickly get on with the people's business. Our challenge today is not to damage the Constitution, not to distort its clear meaning when it states in Article 2, Section 4 that the President of the United States should be impeached only on grounds of treason, bribery, and other crimes and misdemeanors. The private acts of William Jefferson Clinton, no matter how reprehensible, do not constitute the intent of the framers by the above language, which suggests acts to undermine or subvert the government. What we have here are not proven facts established like a court of law by the give and take of questioning witnesses to what happens through a legally constituted jury that has handed down a guilty verdict. All we have are mere allegations brought to the Judiciary Committee by what appears to be a determined independent counsel. In perjury, the declarant must willfully offer testimony that the declarant believes is false before an individual can be convicted of perjury. No evidence presented by the majority has ever proven that the president believed that he
said false items. In fact, the credibility of a major witness relied upon by the majority was never tested in our committee. Mr. Shippers, the chief investigative counsel for the House Judiciary Committee, said Ms. Lewinsky's credibility may be subject to some skepticism. At an appropriate stage of the proceedings, that credibility will, of necessity, be assessed with the credibility of all witnesses in light of all the other evidence. That never happened. Mr. Shippers further charges the president with abuse of power. In committee, I raised the following question to Mr. Ruff, the president's lawyer. Abuse of power requires the use of power. Did President Clinton in any way ask any of the members of his cabinet to use the powers of their office to help cover up his affair with Monica Lewinsky? His answer in part was, no, Congresswoman. The American people have heard the charges of perjury, obstruction of justice, and they certainly know when a president has abused his power, caused his cabinet offices to use the powers of their office in a conspiracy to cover up anything. This did not occur. How can we even begin to consider the statements of the president to his own wife to shield an inappropriate relationship that he had been having as an abuse of power? That is what the independent counsel would have you believe. It is preposterous, and it shortchanges the intelligence and perceptiveness of the American people. Now let me briefly note the process in which we've engaged in since the referral was sent to this committee in September 1998. There have been, including today, under 10 hearings by this committee that would decide the fate of this nation. There have been no fact witnesses brought by the majority who, under our well-understood system of justice, bear the heavy burden of proving that an impeachable offense has indeed been committed. And we have seen Mr. Starr, holding the same role as Leon Jaworski in 1974, remove his hat of objectivity and move from impartially referring the facts to being an advocate for the president's impeachment. Even worse, we've literally seen the prosecutor in this matter step away from his position as an officer of the court and step into the role of the witness in chief against the president of the United States. And this occurred to the horror of Mr. Starr's own ethics advisor, Sam Dash, who resigned because of it. This perverts the role of the Office of Independent Counsel and violates the rules of professional conduct that all lawyers and judges must abide by. Mr. Jaworski was so concerned about subpoenaed material from the House Judiciary Committee in 1974 that he was willing to contest it. Now, however, where do we go from here? In Dr. Martin Luther King's book, Where Do We Go From Here, he talked about the limited gains that we have obtained in civil rights. He said, however, conscience burned dimly. Justice of the deepest level had but few stalwart champions. We must find in this room today more stalwarts for justice, more champions for justice, those with courage to do the right thing, in fact, an uncommon courage. Somewhat similar to Daniel Webster, who I raised today in his March 7, 1850 speech, when in attempt to hold this floundering union together, he said, Mr. President, he began, I wish to speak today not as a Massachusetts man, not as a northern man, but as an American and a member of the Senate of the United States. I speak today for the preservation of the Union. Hear me for my cause. He was more concerned with avoiding the secession of the states. He wanted to maintain the liberty and the safety of the Union. When he finished, there was no applause, but Daniel Webster did succeed. But he succeeded in the light of great vilification. I know of no deed in American history done by a son of New England to which I can compare this, but the act of Benedict Arnold. Webster said, Horace Mann is a fallen star, Lucifer defending from heaven. But Daniel Webster maintained his support for the Union. So today I will join my colleagues and offer a censure resolution to bring the nation together, to heal the political schism, sharp as it appears. Rebuke, reprimand, condemn, censure the president. I believe censure is right, punitive, and just, and we must have the courage to find that level of cooperation even in this committee. Those who will argue for impeachment want the ultimate act, removal of the president from office. And under these articles, a lifetime ban of the president ever being in public service again, appointed voluntary. However, constitutional scholars have said there are no grounds for determining that Mr. Clinton's behavior subverted the Constitution. The punishment should fit the crime. Mr. Clinton has wounded his family and his country and admitted to an inappropriate relationship. Nevertheless, would deviance from traditionally moral, acceptable patterns of behavior be sufficient grounds for impeachment? Every reading of the Constitution will suggest they had no such triviality in mind, but rather major offenses against the state. What actions have posed a threat to the security of the nation and its position in world politics? Need one answer? I would not have anyone draw the conclusion that the behavior of the president should be condoned. His own counsel said it was maddening, or that I would recommend this as a model for our youth of America. God help our parents and our religious institutions to be their guide. On the contrary, I join with millions of other Americans in condemning the president's behavior, yet impeachment would not be grounded in the Constitution and has not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Wayne Owens, who served on this committee in 1974, said if you vote to impeach a president because he had an improper sexual affair, then avoided full disclosure, you impeach on that narrow base of personal, not official, misconduct. You do untold damage to the Constitution and to the stability of future presidents. To those men and women, House members, who are now searching their souls with censure, you stamp this president's legacy forever, but you maintain the stability of the institution of the presidency. In The Gathering Storm, Winston Churchill recommended special kinds of behavior under special conditions: in war, resolution, and in peace, goodwill. Because we are men and women of goodwill, always wanting the best for our nation, when the dust of rhetoric and stage performance had settled, and we would be able to sit down and reason together. For together we possess the qualities of men and women called by Jay Holland. God, give us men and women a time like this demands. Strong minds, great hearts, true faith. Tall men and women who live above the fog in public duty and private thinking. Mr. Chairman, we are morally bound to make our disapproval known, but we can best do it through censure, an act which would help us maintain constitutional integrity and to ensure that Lincoln's dream of the future will remain a constant reality, that we will continue to live in a nation where there is government of the people, by the people, and for the people. So today, Mr. Chairman, I vote no on the articles of impeachment, and yes, on censure to heal this nation.
The gentleman's time has expired.
The House Judiciary Committee is debating articles of impeachment. You're listening live coverage over National Public Radio. This morning, we're hearing opening statements, 10 minutes each, from the members. The next speaker is Republican William Jenkins of Tennessee.
430 members of the House of Representatives voted for an inquiry of one magnitude or another. We're here to consider the conduct of a president of the United States. The committee did not initiate or encourage the conduct that brought us here. The Congress did not initiate or encourage the conduct that brought us here. The conduct was the conduct solely of the accused. Initially, it was a private matter that was met with reactions ranging from forgiveness to condemnation. Later, it gravitated to giving false testimony under oath, in depositions, and before a grand jury. We have heard sworn factual deposition testimony and sworn testimony from witnesses with a wide range of opinions. Most of the witnesses were very capable and well prepared. One witness recounted her own false testimony about a strikingly familiar personal relationship that led to her conviction for obstruction of justice. One witness appeared intent on dictating, even threatening, rather than informing the committee, declaring in advance the historical condemnation of the committee and the entire Congress. Defense lawyers have constantly attacked the special counsel and his investigators. They have attacked the committee in their review of the referral of the special counsel. They have attacked the committee in accomplishing the task assigned to the committee by the full House of Representatives in House Resolution 581. It was not until the last day of the hearing, and then for a very few minutes, that defense counsel provided any factual evidence that the accused did not engage in the conduct charged, or that the conduct did not constitute perjury, obstruction of justice, or abuse of power. Wide-ranging testimony has been given to this committee about the burden of proof required to send this matter to the full House of Representatives. In my mind, the evidence is sufficient to vote some articles to the House of Representatives. Also, to fail to do so would deny the citizens across the United States, through their elected representatives, their voice and their vote on this divisive issue. From all of this, the committee must decide if the president committed perjury, obstructed justice, or abused the power of his office, and if these constitute grounds for impeachment. Throughout this proceeding, many expressions of concern have been voiced about the presidency itself. I share these concerns and have for decades. Since 1960, one president has been tragically assassinated. One president was driven out of office and did not seek re-election. One president was caused to resign. Three good presidents were voted out of office after one full or a partial term of office. Only one president thus far in almost four decades has served two full terms in office. The presidency, I think, is under attack. But amid this concern, there has been little mention that presidents themselves can strengthen the presidency by conducting themselves in a manner that brings pride and admiration and confidence to the minds of all our citizens. We will soon know the conclusion of this committee's work. After it ends, whatever the outcome, I hope we will have a renewed and increased spirit of cooperation to strengthen Social Security, to make our health care system more compatible to and considerate of patients and their physicians, to ensure that we have a strong national defense, to ensure that our children receive a good education. After all, we started this great republic with a goal set out in the preamble of the Constitution to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, to promote the general welfare, and to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity. If there is a vote to impeach, it will not be the end of our republic. Although our system is indeed fragile, it has survived impeachment. It has survived two world wars and numerous other conflicts, the Great Depression, and a very bitter Civil War. The country survived these things partly because we believe that we all, and the least among us, are entitled to a measure of dignity, and to be dealt with fairly, and to not be overwhelmed by the most powerful among us. In order to continue that belief, those who have the mantle of leadership, who have power and privileges beyond the knowledge of the average citizen, and beyond the belief of some who have knowledge, must be expected to meet basic responsibilities. One of those responsibilities is to tell the truth under oath, as every citizen is required to do. If these responsibilities are not met, the average ordinary American is overwhelmed. Our survival will indeed be in question. For those invested with great power and privileges, it seems to me that the simple code for them to follow is this: to whom much is given, much is expected in return. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Jenkins. Mr. Wexler, gentleman from Florida.
Robert Wexler is a Democrat from Boca Raton, Florida.
I would first like to commend our colleague from Massachusetts, Mr. Frank, with respect to his opening remarks yesterday, in which he described the powerful ramifications of being censured or reprimanded by this House. His comments, I believe, were courageous and, I hope, illuminating. Mr. Chairman, this has been the scariest week of my life. I listened to Mr. Ruff, counsel to the president, and Mr. Lowell, counsel for the minority, each present a fact-by-fact rebuttal of the case against the president. I read the 184-page report by the president's lawyers that established the president did not commit grand jury perjury, did not obstruct justice, did not tamper with witnesses, and certainly the president did not abuse his office. But the Republicans on this committee did not listen. In fact, they drafted their articles of impeachment even before Mr. Ruff concluded the president's defense. This process has been a sham from the beginning. Wake up, America. They are about to impeach our president. They are about to reverse two national elections. They are about to discard your votes. They are about to exercise a congressional power that has been used only twice before in our nation's history. Before the Starr report was delivered to Congress, the Republicans said they would not even try to impeach the president over just the Monica Lewinsky affair. They promised grand White House conspiracies of misused FBI files, Whitewater land deals, and travel office abuses. They promised patterns of lawbreaking. They found nothing. They said they would not impeach without public outrage. But much to their dismay, the minds of the American people have not changed. The overwhelming number of Americans do not want this president impeached based on this flimsy case. Well, wake up, America. This elitist group has decided that they know better than you. This committee will vote straight down party lines to impeach and remove the President of the United States of America. The articles of impeachment actually say William Jefferson Clinton warrants impeachment and trial and removal from office. And what's it all about? Sex. They use criminal terms like perjury. But guess what the perjury is really about? The alleged perjury is about the discrepancy between the president's and Miss Lewinsky's testimony about the details of their relationship. You see, at the grand jury, the president admitted he had inappropriate, intimate contact with Monica Lewinsky of a physical nature. He acknowledged that it was wrong. But the president didn't specifically admit the details of his encounters with Miss Lewinsky, like who touched who and where. And the president denied having sexual relations with Miss Lewinsky under the distorted definition put forth by the Paula Jones attorneys, a definition that even the presiding judge, Judge Wright, said was confusing. Imagine that the impeachment of the President of the United States hinges on a tortured definition of sex. That's what the perjury in the grand jury is all about, folks. But they're going to impeach the president anyway. The Republicans on this committee say the president tampered with witnesses. Well, you better wake up, America. You could be tampering with the witness and not even know it. Because according to the majority on this committee, you can be guilty of witness tampering a person who is not a witness in any case. The facts clearly show that Betty Currie was not listed as a witness or a potential witness at the time of the alleged tampering. But they
are going to impeach the president anyway. They claim the president has obstructed justice. But let's look at the facts underlying these damning charges. Their star witness, Monica Lewinsky, testified under oath that nobody, nobody asked her to lie, and nobody offered her a job
Music
for her
by
silence.
Richard Wagner.
But
we've heard the prelude.
They are going
Good
to impeach
Friday
the president
his
anyway.
Parsifal.
They claim the president abused his power.
How? RCA recording.
By asserting his constitutional rights and privileges pursuant to the advice of his lawyers. Well, wake up, America, because if they can do it to the president, they can do it to you. If this committee supports an article of impeachment for abuse of power, they will be saying that any American who goes into court and claims their constitutional protections is at risk. How un-American! But they are going to impeach him anyway and extend our national nightmare for another year by sending this weightless case to the Senate for trial. So wake up, America. Our government is about to shut down. The public's business will grind to a halt. The Senate, the Supreme Court, and the House of Representatives will all be hostage to a process that never should have been triggered in the first place. If you're sick of all Monica all the time, you ain't seen nothing yet. Be prepared to turn on your TV and watch the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court swear in Lucianne Goldberg, Linda Tripp. Endless testimony in front of the whole world showcasing America at its most absurd. When we started these proceedings, I expressed my fear that this impeachment, if successful, would forever lower the standard for impeachment for future presidents. In my worst nightmare, I did not foresee this. There is no standard left. They have trashed it. They have trivialized the Founding Fathers' standard of treason, bribery, or other high crimes or misdemeanors. They have made a mockery of this process. Clearly, there is no case for impeachment. The truth is, Mr. Chairman, if the question before this committee were about the morality of the president's actions, there would be no debate. The president's conduct was wrong. He did lie to the American people. In fact, for those of us who believe in this president, who are committed to his policies, who are motivated by his centrist philosophy, who are moved by his compassion for people, the president's relationship with Monica Lewinsky was more than wrong. It was heartbreaking. How could he have been so foolish? How could he have done such a reckless thing? There are no good answers to these questions. But I believe in my heart that morality is a complex equation, that good people sometimes do bad things, that moral people sometimes commit immoral acts. And when I look at the totality of this case, I am left with one undeniable conclusion. The president betrayed his wife. He did not betray his country. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. The gentleman from Arkansas, Mr. Hutchinson.
Asa Hutchinson, a Republican from Fayetteville, Arkansas.
For 25 years, Bill Clinton has been a state and national star. President Clinton carried my state of Arkansas in the last election. He ran for the seat of Congress that I now hold and has served my state as Attorney General and Governor. During this hearings, his negatives have been emphasized, but I am mindful that there are many qualities of Bill Clinton that I admire and of even greater significance that people of my state admire. When he is elected president, it was a unique opportunity for a small state, not likely to be repeated. There's no question but that all of this impacts him and his family. And when he expresses regret for his actions and requests forgiveness for his conduct, I have no hesitation in saying he should receive our compassion and encouragement. For those reasons, among others, this is not a pleasant experience for me. What I have discussed are personal issues of profound significance, but my responsibilities require me to consider the legal and constitutional consequences to the conduct in question. We on the committee are not jurors, but I am reminded of the instruction a judge gives to juries. You are not to be guided by your sympathies or prejudice, but by the facts and the law. In my judgment, that describes the duty of this committee. So let us look at the facts. The evidence has been established through sworn testimony under oath, corroborated in many instances by documentary evidence, from computer disks to telephone records. The sworn testimony includes that of Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky, Betty Curry, Vernon Jordan, and others. The testimony establishes a pattern of false statements, deceit, and obstruction. By committing these actions, the president moved beyond the private arena of protecting embarrassing personal conduct, and his actions invaded the very heart and soul of that which makes this nation unique in the world, the right of any citizen to pursue justice equally. The conduct obstructed our judicial system, and at that point became an issue, not of personal concern, but of national consequence. The clarion call for justice in this land was established in the preamble to our Constitution, which states, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union," and then it says, "to establish justice, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." The second purpose stated for ordaining the Constitution was to establish justice. It is not for the president or his lawyers to determine who can or cannot seek justice. And if the president lied under oath in a federal civil rights case, then he took it upon himself to deny the right of a fellow American, in this case, a fellow Arkansan, equal access to relief in the courts. The president's lawyers have declared such a lie to be a small one, of small consequence, and therefore not impeachable. But I cannot see how denying the rights of a fellow citizen could be considered of small consequence. Now, speaking of the facts, it has been pointed out that the grand jury testimony of the various witnesses has not been subject to cross-examination. That is true. However, each of these witnesses are strongly sympathetic to the president. Vernon Jordan, his personal advisor and longtime friend. Betty Curry, his employee. And Monica Lewinsky, who resisted for months providing any statement to the independent counsel and who would be subject to prosecution for any false statement. Of greatest significance, though, is the testimony of the president himself. The president's own words and admissions, combined with a dose of common sense, support the charge that the president lied under oath. The evidence not only shows the president giving perjurious statements, but he continues his assault on the judicial system by soliciting and encouraging false statements by others. This is evidence of an effort to obstruct justice. And that leads me to the second argument raised by the president's lawyers. Even if the president lied under oath, even if he obstructed justice under these facts, that does not constitute an impeachable offense. Let me address that argument. Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers said that impeachment must relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to society itself. Justice Story said impeachment should be reserved for great injuries to the state. I believe the damage to the state and to the integrity of government occurs when those in high office violate a court oath and the constitutional oath to assure the faithful execution of the laws. One of the president's own witnesses, former Congressman Wayne Owens, stated in 1974 that for an action to be impeachable conduct, quote, it must be a violation of a principle of conduct which members of the House determined should be applied to all future presidents and established as a constitutional precedent, end quote. I believe Mr. Owens is correct. I have no trouble in setting a benchmark that future presidents cannot willfully and repeatedly lie under oath in an official judicial proceeding without jeopardizing their office. On the contrary, I have a great deal of trouble in lowering the standards to say to future presidents, lying under oath, no matter how often and no matter how intentional, is considered acceptable conduct. As the Supreme Court said in United States versus Holland, quote, perjury, regardless of the setting, is a serious offense that results in incalculable harm to the function of the legal system as well to private individuals, end quote. In my judgment, perjury goes to the heart of our judicial process and our very system of government and constitutes a high crime and misdemeanor. What happens if we fail to act? It appears to me that we quietly embrace and even aid in the gradual subversion of our core belief that we are a nation of laws and that all of us, regardless of wealth or power, deserve equal treatment in the eyes of the law. The next offense is that presented on behalf of the president is that independent counsel Kenneth Starr did not conduct the investigation properly and therefore we should not move forward. There have been many criticisms of Judge Starr, some justified and some without merit. In hindsight, I would have preferred that the Attorney General had appointed a different independent counsel on the Lewinsky matter, that Judge Starr had been more actively involved in interviewing the witnesses, that he had not engaged in outside representation, and that he had been less of an advocate and more of a conduit of the facts. But let me assure everyone that I have engaged in an independent review of the facts, and despite these criticisms, the President had a decision to make when he testified in the civil deposition and in the grand jury. He could tell the truth, or he could lie. The Supreme Court has said in United States versus Manduano that the defendant was free at every stage to interpose his constitutional privilege against self-incrimination, but perjury was not a permissible option. The court rejected the defendant's argument that his testimony, because it was obtained in violation of his rights, could not be used in the criminal prosecution. The conclusion is that allegations of misconduct on the part of the government is not an excuse for perjury. It is reminiscent of every criminal case that I have prosecuted to hear the president's lawyers attack the prosecutor, blame this committee, criticize the process, and refuse to take responsibility. I concede his lawyers that tactic, but I have also urged them to show me compelling facts rebutting the long trail of evidence suggesting that the president lied under oath and obstructed justice. This they have not done to my satisfaction. The final argument of the president is that to go forward with an impeachment trial would traumatize the country. First, as usual, I believe that the trauma is overstated. But more importantly, the strength of the Constitution is understated. I believe our Constitution is strong, and we need to follow it and trust it. It will work as the Founding Fathers designed it. As Barbara Jordan stated in a similar time in 1974, my faith in the Constitution is whole. It is complete. It is total. I share that belief. In the next few days, I will cast some of the most important votes of my career. Some believe these votes could result in a backlash and have serious political repercussions. They may be right, but I will leave the analysis to others. My preeminent concern is that the Constitution be followed and that all Americans, regardless of their position in society, receive equal and unbiased treatment in our courts of law. The fate of no president, no political party, and no member of Congress merits a slow unraveling of the fabric of our constitutional structure. As John Adams said, we are a nation of laws, not of men. Our nation has survived the failings of its leaders before, but it cannot survive exceptions to the rule of law and our system of equal justice for all. There will always be differences between the powerful and the powerless, but imagine a country where a Congress agrees the strong are treated differently than the weak, where mercy is the only refuge for the powerless, where the power of our positions govern all of our decisions. Such a country cannot long endure. God help us to do what is right, not just for today, but for the future of this nation and for those generations that must succeed us. Thank you.
This is live coverage of the House Judiciary Committee's debate on impeachment. We're listening to opening statements from the members. This is coming to you from NPR News. The next speaker will be Democrat Thomas Barrett from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
The gravity of the matter before us. For the decision we make today is important not only now, but important for future members of Congress and for our children and grandchildren as well. The president's actions were wrong. It was wrong for him to make false statements concerning his reprehensible conduct with a subordinate. And it was wrong for him to take steps to delay discovery of the truth. But the constitutional question is not whether his actions were right or wrong. The question is whether his actions rise to the level of an impeachable offense, and if so, should we invoke this drastic constitutional remedy of impeachment, set aside the only national election in this country, and remove him from office? And ultimately, the question is what is best for the people of this country. To answer these questions, we have to ask another question. Who committed these sins? Were these the sins of Bill Clinton, the president, or Bill Clinton, the man? To some, this is a distinction without a difference. But I believe the framers of our Constitution contemplated a distinction when they wrote of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. For if it was Bill Clinton, the president, if any wrongdoing he committed was committed against the body politic, if it undermined our representative form of government, then it would be necessary to remove him from office. Not to punish him, but to ensure that our democratic form of government is safeguarded. But if the sin were committed by Bill Clinton, the man, sins nonetheless, the decision becomes more difficult. As our predecessors on this committee recognized 24 years ago, impeachment is reserved for grave offenses against the state, those that threaten our system of government. Not all crimes are impeachable. One must examine the conduct in question to determine whether it is impeachable. Most offenses undermine one thing or another. That is why they are prescribed by the criminal law. Most people would agree that running a red light does not fall within that narrow category of offenses that are impeachable. But if everyone did it, countless people would die on unsafe streets. So the question isn't whether lying under oath or perjury undermine the system of justice in a general sense. The question is whether the specific conduct represents a grave offense against the state and is a threat to our system of government. Assuming that the evidence before us, most of it hearsay untested by cross-examination, did establish perjury and obstruction of justice, I would have to conclude that the matters the president allegedly lied about, the matters he allegedly obstructed justice about, are not, except in the most attenuated abstract sense, a threat to our system of government. This case is not like Watergate, which involved the obvious and direct misuse of government power. And it is not a case of lying or obstruction on a matter of public concern. We cannot escape the fact that the president's misconduct related to his private life. It was not a grave and dangerous offense against the state. It does not threaten our republic. And we need not remove him to protect our democracy. I acknowledge that there are exceptions to the rule that high crimes and misdemeanors must relate to public conduct. If a president had committed murder, not an offense against our representative form of government, I would vote for impeachment. I believe I would be so offended by the immorality and the intrinsic wrongfulness of the act that our democratic system of government would have to be cleansed of the wrongdoing. The allegations against the president, although serious, do not rise to this level. So I must conclude that perjury, per se, does not constitute an impeachable offense as intended by our forefathers. This is where I pause. I pause because the allegations against the president do raise questions about his character. I ask myself, if it were a Republican president in this predicament, what would I do? Would I maintain consistency and impose impeachment even if I both opposed his public policies and personal conduct? I pray that I would treat the two situations consistently, and I pray I never have to face that question. To those who fear that a vote against impeachment would mean that it's okay to lie, it's okay to mislead and deceive, I submit that this president has not and will not escape punishment. He has suffered a public humiliation that few will ever know. And humiliation is not the end of his troubles. If we reject impeachment in the next few days, we can censure and condemn him for his conduct. There is no constitutional bar to censure. It is within our power. More importantly, it is the just and appropriate remedy for this misconduct. For a man undoubtedly concerned about his place in history, this is no small punishment. He would be only the second president of the United States ever censured. What's more, we should not forget that President Clinton is subject to criminal prosecution after he completes his term of office. He is neither above the law nor below it. He can and should be treated like every other citizen who may have committed similar offenses. Unfortunately, the president's conduct is not the only unsettling component to our present crisis. I am also deeply, deeply troubled by the events leading up to the president's deposition in the Jones case. There clearly was a channel of communication between Ken Starr's office and Paula Jones' attorneys through Linda Tripp. And I believe her motives and actions, in part personal and part political, cannot be ignored here. If we are to set aside our only national election, we must be confident that political enemies or political motives did not set the stage for this political morality play. For if they did, then there is a potentially greater danger here to our democracy than lying about sex. The grave act of setting aside a national election cannot be agitated by those forces that fail to prevail at the ballot box.
Comes from the stockpot.
I stress again that my deep concern about the Linda Tripp connection in no way excuses Bill Clinton for his wrongdoing. That is why it is important that he remain subject to appropriate criminal and civil action after he leaves office. And that is why it is important that this institution impose a sanction appropriate to the president's action.
Labeled inquisitive.
That is why I favor censure.
Cartoon music.
A censure reflects the gravity of the president's wrongdoing.
The origins of this.
I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your decision to permit a vote on our censure resolution here in committee. And could be I agree played with by you an that it will foster comedy.
The famous silent film
but Dance. I have another request.
But mostly,
not just to
the
you,
had to make
but to all my colleagues on this committee.
The film and
I have listened as many, if not most, members on the Republican side of the aisle have asserted that this is a vote of conscience.
Of appropriate material.
And Mr. Schippers, in his closing arguments, specifically noted the importance of voting one's conscience.
Moods, edited
I respect
by
each
Rupay,
and every member of this committee who votes his or her conscience.
This was published
on a matter as important as this, party identification should not be, must not be, the deciding factor.
Of neutral,
conscience
seven
must be.
Different numbers which are meant
so
to
my request to you is a simple
where none of the
aforesaid
three situations are common. That is, where there is neither action nor atmosphere.
Both here in committee and on the floor, please allow our censure resolution to move to the Rules Committee either on a positive or negative vote. I and many others in this Congress should not be denied the right to vote our conscience, the right that many here assert genuinely, I believe, as their rationale for supporting impeachment.
On each and every one of the pages.
To deny us that right would be the rawest of raw partisan politics.
Grotesque. Gruesome,
it would confirm the fear
horror,
that party humorous, leaders and not conscience
monotony,
are dictating
orgies,
this committee's action.
Parties, passion, pastoral,
not a single member of this institution should
quiet,
fear a vote of conscience.
Sound recording.
Not a single member of this Congress should be part of any plan to deny any other member of Congress the opportunity
scores
to vote their conscience on an issue of as grave constitutional importance as this.
More or less modeled on Wagner.
Mr. Chairman, as you know, I joined this committee the day it received the Starr report. I am the most junior member. I honestly walked into the first hearing believing our proceeding would be nonpartisan. I don't know if I was more like Mr. Smith goes to Washington or Gomer Pyle. I even thought that we might be sitting physically like grand jurors, individually, not divided by party like gladiators fighting a partisan fight. But I was wrong. And I think many members of this committee, on both sides of the aisle, are disappointed
as
on
I
how
said,
partisan
stock music is not noted
I
for
think
its
any of us intended
indeed, it,
to it
has
way
to make its point instantly.
Perhaps I'm
try
as
this
naive now as I was when I first joined the committee. But I don't think so. I call it optimism. Because I believe my colleagues on this committee recognize that
you
our
can imagine
vote
what
of
that
conscience
is. The big
may
city,
be
right?
Different.
It's called Skyscraper
their
City.
Vote of conscience.
Not all stock music
and
is
I believe that you know
in
fact,
your
heart
a more
of heart.
It,
that it would be a partisan
sound,
tactic
fashion show
to
rock
prevent us from voting our conscience. Let's leave this room together, not as Democrats and Republicans. Let us leave this room as Americans, hand in hand, and take the votes to the floor of the House of Representatives. Conscience will prevail, conscience should prevail, and if that happens, justice will prevail.
Let's wind
I yield
up
back
with
the balance of my time.
Entitled music.
I thank the gentleman, Mr. Pease, the gentleman from Indiana.
Kevin Pease, Republican.
We are of such nature and consequence that I like so many others, have struggled to impose on myself a discipline of open-mindedness for as long as I possibly could.
The whole city laid out before you.
That decision has had its consequences, as I have found myself criticized from across the political spectrum for not declaring myself nor advocating a conclusion, even as the committee was still receiving evidence and hearing argument.
You too can buy or rent.
I understand and accept those consequences as inevitable, just as, though I wish fervently this matter were not before us, wishing will not make it so.
This is NPR.
My intention was to prepare these remarks personally following the conclusion of the president's defense on Wednesday, assuming I would have several hours to collect my thoughts
from Opus 1 by
and do the
Niccolo
best
Paganini,
I could to present them in a fashion that measures up to the importance of the moment.
13 in B flat, 14 in E flat,
instead, I went to the Ford building,
in E minor,
reviewed again the evidence presented by Mr. Ruff in his thoughtful defense of the president, went to my office to review the notes I've made over the last few months, and went to God in prayer for guidance and strength. These thoughts, therefore, are collected in bits and pieces as time has availed itself in limited supply during the last day and a half, and now it's time for decisions. I believe I owe an explanation of the process by which I reached them. It seemed to me that I must first decide the role which this committee assumes. Some have argued that we're akin to a grand jury and that we need simply find probable cause of commission of high crimes and misdemeanors in order to approve articles of impeachment. Others contend that we must be convinced that the trier of fact, in this case the Senate, would convict on an article before it could be reported out. Though there is a difference between this matter and the prosecution of a crime, I believe that there's a parallel between the decision to indict and the decision to impeach in this regard. While a prosecutor should not, in my view, bring a case unless he is convinced under the law and the facts that an unbiased jury would convict, the House and the committee in its role recommending to the House should not vote articles of impeachment unless it also believes that the Senate, looking only at the Constitution and the facts, would convict as well. As to the standard of proof, there are those who argue that since this is not a criminal matter, the usual standard in civil cases, preponderance of the evidence, should obtain. Some believe that since there are parallels to criminal law, or because the matter is of such national import, the criminal standard of beyond a reasonable doubt should be employed. As I've already distinguished this from criminal prosecution, but because I believe that the standard must be higher than that normally the case in civil proceedings, I've determined to evaluate the allegations against the president by the standard of clear and convincing evidence. Most difficult is the determination of what constitutes a high crime or misdemeanor. The founders deliberately left us without a definition, and though it would in some senses have made our work easier had they crafted one, I believe that their decision was right for the nation. Some contend that the action complained of must be and can only be an offense against the state, one that constitutes a direct attack on the body politic. Others observe that while such actions would clearly qualify, they are not exclusive of other actions, even personal actions, but of a clearly heinous nature. Others submit that since the constitutional language is high crimes and misdemeanors, there can be no impeachment unless there is first a prosecutable crime. As I've earlier observed, I am not prepared to accept that the standard of performance for an American president is simply that he or she is not indictable. I agree with those who assert that every American is entitled to privacy in his or her personal life, and that no matter what we may think of another's actions in that regard, it is, to use the vernacular, simply none of our business, period. Our business does include, though, the performance of public duties, the integrity of the judicial process, and the protection and defense of the Constitution. Accordingly, I have concluded that perjury or false statements under oath, obstruction of justice, and abuse of the office of the presidency are all impeachable offenses. I believe, given the facts before this committee, that each of them has been proven by a preponderance of the evidence in this case. I also believe, though, that every presumption in favor of the president must be made, both regarding the facts and regarding the standard of proof. The more I've seen and read of the president's statements, both under oath and otherwise, the more difficult this has become. But I have persisted. Having reviewed and reviewed the material, I do not believe that all of the allegations presented meet the standard of being proven by clear and convincing evidence. The final assessment of which meet what I believe to be the necessary higher standard of proof will depend in part on the form the articles take after the committee completes the amendatory process. Given what I know now, though, I anticipate that I will conclude this matter the way I began it, somehow managing to irritate virtually everyone in my district who holds an opinion on the subject. Those who believe there's nothing here will be disappointed to know that I believe there is. Those who want me to do everything I can to vilify this president in every way possible will be disappointed to know that my assessment on the facts cannot allow me to do so. I long ago gave up the notion that I could depart these proceedings undamaged, so I have done what I have always known I must do anyway: depend on the Constitution as my compass and my conscience as my guide. As I conclude, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer an observation about this committee. It's often been called one of the most polarized in the Congress. The confrontational approach so regularly seen here is one that I abhor and which has made service even more difficult for me than it might otherwise have been. There are members here with whom I strongly disagree. There are some I find annoying, even abrasive. But I believe all of the members of this committee are decent human beings who are honestly trying to do the right thing as they see it. Over the last few months, I've met with a subset of this committee, Republicans and Democrats, in an effort to maintain communication, look for consensus, reaffirm respect. I've learned many things from them and from others on this committee, for which I will always be grateful. But one seems especially pertinent today. Our votes will likely be characterized by many as strictly partisan, implying that decisions here will be made simply on the basis of party affiliation. I believe firmly that each of us has honestly, sincerely struggled to do what he or she believed must be done, and that party affiliation was not the basis for decisions made here. Those who contend otherwise regarding members in either party do a disservice to the members of this committee, to their work, and to the Congress. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I yield the balance of my time.
I thank the gentleman, the distinguished gentleman from Utah, Mr. Kim.
Christopher Cannon from Provo, Utah.
Your steady hand on the tiller of this committee, you've done so through personal criticism, roiling debate and alliances, and I appreciate your steadiness there.
The Queen's honor list.
We are at a defining moment in our history. What we do here will set the standard for what is acceptable for this and future presidents. I believe profoundly that the behavior of this president is unacceptable, because I agree with John Jay, one of our founding fathers, who said, "When oaths cease to be sacred, our dearest and most valuable rights become insecure." Let me just repeat that. When oaths cease to be sacred, our dearest and most valuable rights become insecure. I believe that, whatever current critics may allege, John F. Kennedy loved and wanted to preserve this most extraordinary constitutional system of ours, as he said. And President Kennedy had something appropriate to say about presidential responsibility and oaths. Please allow me to share a comment by President Kennedy regarding oaths And would you please direct your attention to the video monitors?
First time one of the members has used a videotape in their speech.
Responsibility of the President of the United States. If responsibility is different from what your responsibility may be, this country, I carry out and execute the laws of the United States. I also have the obligation of implementing the orders of the courts of the United States. And I can assure you that who's ever President of the United States, he will do the same. Because if he did not, he would begin to unwind this most extraordinary constitutional system of ours. So, I believe as strongly in fulfilling my oath in that regard.
John Jay and President Kennedy were looking at the world from a similar perspective. I invite you to consider the context from which they were speaking. Our dearest rights, which Jay referred, are set forth in the Declaration of Independence. They are the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, commonly referred to as the right to property, with which we are endowed by our Creator. In other words, these rights are of divine origin, but they are subject to mortal abuse. The purpose of government to Jay and to Kennedy is to make those rights secure against abuse. What does the sacredness of oaths have to do with the security of our rights? President Kennedy thought that if a president were not to fulfill his obligations, the obligations of his oaths, that he would begin, that is the president, any president, he suggested, that he would begin to unwind this most extraordinary constitutional system of government. He was not, and we are not, talking about separation of powers. We're not talking about the other constitutional concepts like the delegated powers, the reservation of powers to the states. Kennedy and Jay are referencing something more fundamental. They are talking about the glue that holds our system together. Now, our system can take a lot of abuse. It is resilient. It can handle strong, spirited debate. It can even handle violent conflicts like the Civil War.
Hard to say if anyone
but attempts to make a sacred oath flexible is like introducing solvent into a system that is glued together. The whole system comes apart. President Kennedy knew this. He was questioned, can you tell us about the outlook for your civil rights program? And, sir, why are you pushing it so vigorously? Kennedy responded, I know that this program has not gotten a lot of support here in Florida. He's talking to an antagonistic audience. They're angry at him because he's doing something that those people didn't want to do. This was a robust debate over civil rights. Kennedy continues, I think you gentlemen should recognize the responsibility of the President of the United States. His responsibility is different from what your responsibility may be. In this country, I carry out and execute the laws of the United States. I also have the obligation of implementing the orders of the courts of the United States. And I can assure you that who's ever President of the United States, he will do the same. Because if he did not, he would begin to unwind this most extraordinary constitutional system of ours. So I believe strongly in fulfilling my oath in that regard. And that regard means if he didn't fulfill his oath, the system would begin to unwind. It's inexorable. We have heard much comparing this matter with Watergate. Nixon is said to have abused citizens through the IRS, the CIA, and the FBI. We do not have before us allegations that this president has done the same, though the popular press reports many abuses. We can and should not, cannot and should not pass judgment on those accusations in these deliberations. That judgment may be for history. But we do want the president and those around him and future presidents and those around them to know that we will not allow weakness of character, willfulness, or any other trait of a president to undermine the sacredness of oaths. Because Kennedy and Jay are right.
National Public Radio.
Some current commentators, even Democratic partisans and presidential supporters, before the president committed the acts of perjury that we now confront, Alan Dershowitz, George Stephanopoulos, and others warned the president that he would be impeached if he lied to the grand jury. It did not occur to them that it could be otherwise. Because I believe, they love this system of government like Jay and Kennedy and like me, members of this committee, members of Congress, and millions of Americans, as well as the millions worldwide to whom America is the beacon of hope and the example of freedom to which they aspire. There are some who call themselves Americans and who understand these principles, who cover them over with facile arguments because they want to preserve their power. I'm not going to deal here with the facts of the case. They are compelling enough that even Democratic members of this committee and witnesses called by the president have acknowledged that the president lied under oath. If anyone has a serious question, I refer you to Mr. Shipper's excellent report. The fact is, the unwinding of this extraordinary constitutional system is inexorable if the president presents an example of perjury. To Kennedy, it was self-evident, and the tape of his words bears repeating. Would you please look at the monitors?
And again, we're going to be watching a video clip of apparently President Kennedy. At the moment, the video monitors do not appear to be cooperating.
I guess we should note that these are Republicans using President Kennedy to make their point, and not noting that President Kennedy had his own sexual problems.
Yeah. Safe then and not counting.
One of his most notorious affairs was with the girlfriend of the mobster Sam Giancana.
I have another sentence or two after we see this, but I yield back, except that I think this is extraordinarily important to see what a president who all of us look to from different perspectives as a great man who was a man who believed.
I bet this worked last night when you tried it out.
Oh, it absolutely did.
Chairman Hyde has already said this will not count against the congressman's time, Congressman Cannon of Utah.
This is a tried and true tactic of both sides, to cite the other party's icons to make their points.
And now the tape is rewinding through President Kennedy's statement, and I think we may be ready to hear it. This is a live coverage of the House Judiciary Committee's debate on impeachment from National Public Radio. We've reached the point where we've heard from all of the Democrats, and we're now hearing the opening statements of the Republicans. And now here's the video clip of President Kennedy. Or maybe not. And I guess when you want to enter the modern world of video production, you take your risks.
Yeah.
And now it's rewinding again through President Kennedy. Backing through his statement, I think it may be ready.
This is
now
just a way to get really extraordinary attention on what I think is an important statement here.
I guess we should say we heard two really very serious pleas. One Democrat, Tom Barrett, one Republican, Ed Pease. Pease said he would vote for some.
Outlook for your civil rights program. And, sir, why are you pushing it so vigorously?
I think that, I know that this program has not gotten great support here in Florida. I think you gentlemen should recognize the responsibility of the President of the United States. His responsibility is different from what your responsibility may be. This country, I carry out and execute the laws of the United States. I also have the obligation of implementing the orders of the courts of the United States. And I can assure you that who's ever president of the United States, he will do the same. Because if he did not, he would begin to unwind this most extraordinary constitutional system of ours. So I believe I'm strongly in fulfilling my oath in that regard.
Thank you for your indulgence. I submit that in the spirit of our founding fathers and John F. Kennedy, that our first duty is to provide for the security of the fundamental rights of Americans. To properly perform that duty, we must vote to impeach the president. Thank you.
Thank the gentleman. The gentleman from California, Mr. Rogan.
James Rogan is a Republican from Pasadena.
The House Judiciary Committee today contemplates articles of impeachment against an incumbent president of the United States. Our committee undertakes its task in an era where the deceitful manipulation of public opinion no longer is viewed as evil, but as art. Propaganda once evoked images of dictators enforcing mind control over the masses. Now we readily bathe ourselves in spin, and we confer the degree of doctor upon those who administer the dosage. In this very sobering hour, the time has come to strip away the spin and propaganda and face the unvarnished truth of what this committee is called upon to review. First, this impeachment inquiry is not, and never was, licensed to rummage through the personal lifestyle of the President of the United States. It is a gross distortion to characterize his present dilemma as only about sex. As Governor Weld said earlier this week, adultery is not an impeachable offense. And the country needs to know that nobody on this committee seeks to make it so. If that is true, then why are these unsavory elements of the president's private life now at issue? It is because the president was a defendant in a sexual harassment civil rights lawsuit. When Paula Jones's lawsuit reached federal court, after much consideration...
This is Michigan State University Radio, WKAR, East Lansing.
To other subordinate female employees with whom he might have solicited or engaged in sexual involvement. This line of questioning was not invented to torment the president. These questions are routine and must be answered every day by defendants in harassment cases throughout the country. Why is this so? It is because the courts want to see if there is any pattern of conduct that might show a similar history either of harassment, abuse, or of granting or denying job promotions. It was in this context that the president first was asked questions about Monica Lewinsky. And it had nothing to do with Judge Starr, Speaker Gingrich, or any member of the Congress of the United States. If lying now becomes acceptable in harassment cases because candor is embarrassing, or because the defendant is just too powerful to be required to tell the truth, we will destroy the sexual harassment protections currently enjoyed by millions of women in the workforce. One cannot fairly claim to support the societal benefits of these harassment laws on the one hand, and then deny the application of these laws to a defendant merely because he is a president who shares their party affiliation. Next, the Constitution solemnly required President Clinton, as a condition of his becoming president, to swear an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, and to take care that our nation's laws be faithfully executed. That oath of obligation required the president to defend our laws that protect women in the workplace, just as it also required him to protect our legal system from perjury, obstruction of justice, and abuse of power. Fidelity to the presidential oath is not dependent on any president's personal threshold of comfort or embarrassment. Neither must it be a slave to the latest polling data. Even more disturbing is the current readiness of some to embrace, out of political ease, a thoroughly bastardized oath, so long as the offender expresses generalized contrition, while at the same time rejecting meaningful constitutional accountability. Consider how far afield these new standards would move us as a nation, since our first president obliged himself to the same oath that now binds Bill Clinton to the Constitution. On the day George Washington became our first president, he pledged to our new country that the foundation of his public policies would be grounded in principles of private morality. He said that by elevating an otherwise sterile government to the level of private moral obligation, our new country would win the affection of its citizens and command the respect of the world. Most significantly, in this first presidential address, Washington presented himself not as a ruler of men, but as a servant of the law. He established the tradition that in America, powerful leaders are subservient to the rule of law and to the consent of the governed. 200 years later, in an era of increasing ethical relativism, it seems almost foreign to modern ears that the first speech ever delivered by a president of the United States was a speech about the relationship between private and public morality. George Washington was not perfect. He certainly was no saint. Soldiers knew his bravery on the battlefield, His national reputation for truthfulness was unquestioned. Washington, a very human being with very human flaws, still could set, by personal example, the standard of measurement for the office of the presidency. Today, from a distance of two centuries, Washington stands as a distant, almost mythical figure. And yet President Clinton and every member of the Congress of the United States have a living, personal connection to him. Like Washington, each of us took a sacred oath to uphold the Constitution and the rule of law. There is no business of government more important than upholding the rule of law. A sound economy amounts to nothing beside it, because without the rule of law, all contracts are placed in doubt and all rights to property become conditional. National security is not more important than the rule of law, because without it, there can be no security and there is little worth defending. The personal popularity of any president pales when weighed against this one fundamental concept that forever distinguishes us from every other nation. No person is above the rule of law. Mr. Chairman, the evidence clearly shows that the president engaged in a repeated and lengthy pattern of felonious conduct, conduct for which ordinary citizens can and have been routinely prosecuted and jailed. This simply cannot be wished or censured away. With his conduct aggravated by a motivation of personal and pecuniary leverage, rather than by national security or some other legitimate government function, the solemnity of my own oath of office obliges me to do what the president has failed to do: defend the rule of law despite any personal or political costs. With a heavy heart, but with an unwavering belief in the appropriateness of the decision, I will cast my vote for articles of impeachment against the President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton. I yield back the balance of my time.
I thank the gentleman, the distinguished gentleman from South Carolina, Mr. Lindsey Graham.
Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina.
One thing I think would be appropriate as we wind toward the end, and Mary and I are, again, as we've always been, the last two to speak here, and let me just say it's been an honor to serve on the committee. I've been on the committee relatively as a junior member. I think Ms. Bono, myself, Jim, and Mr. Barrett have all come on relatively in the late stages of the last Congress or this Congress, and it's something I'll remember for the rest of my life, I can assure you that. I doubt if I'll ever do anything as important for my nation as having served on this committee. I've been an Air Force officer serving overseas as a prosecutor. I've been an Air Force officer serving stateside as a defense attorney defending men and women accused of crimes in the military. I'm very honored for that experience. I've served in the Air National Guard, representing men and women's legal interests during Desert Shield and Desert Storm with my unit. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to compliment you on two things. Over 50 years ago, when my father was in the Far East serving America in New Guinea, fighting the Japanese, you were in that part of the world serving America, protecting the Constitution, protecting the rule of law, risking your life. And we all owe a debt of gratitude to you and your generation for having done so. I think we owe a unique debt of gratitude to you now for having guided this committee somewhat under fire at a time when we're going to evaluate who we are as a people, how far we've come in 200 years. Have we made progress? Have we gone backward? What's the state of the American people? What's the state of the American political system? I will say this. The people who fought and died should feel good. We're going to have a partisan vote, but that's okay. You have parties. You have political thought. You have political differences. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. A lot of people fought and died so you can have those differences. Let me share some thoughts about my colleagues, and we'll talk about the evidence and the truth. Mr. Frank has made a statement that I'd like to associate myself with. This is about the Monica Lewinsky episode. This is not about Whitewater. That has not been put at the feet of the president. This is not about Filegate. That was not put at the feet of the president. This is not about Travelgate. That was never put at the feet of the president. That's important. Quite frankly, I thought some of these things would mature into cases that would come before this committee. They did not. And we should not mislead people that we're voting on anything other than what happened in the Paula Jones sexual harassment lawsuit. And we'll all make a decision at the end of the day. Is that worth overturning a national election? Mr. Berman, I would like to associate myself with his comments. This is not all about sex, but it's colored by sex. It certainly is. Mr. Rogan has told you about the sexual harassment nature that got us into this whole situation. And I think he did so far better than I can comment because there are some important concepts. But in many ways, this is all about people. This is all about emotion. This is really all about one man.
From a book of
Bill Clinton.
Were loot, published around 15.
There's some really cast of characters here, the Linda Tripps of the world.
You heard five pieces.
Ken Starr, whether you like him or not. There's some unique characters here, myself, whether you like me or not.
Finally, a Piva.
But at the end of the day,
Paul Odette,
we're here because of what Bill Clinton did or chose not to do. Mr. Barrett, I would like to associate myself with his spirit. He's a very nice man. He's got a child coming along, a new child to be brought in the world, and we all wish him well. He has tried to say to this committee, let's bring the country together. What a noble cause. Don't worry, Mr. Barrett, if we don't come together. This country is strong. We shall survive. Mr. Schumer, I admire him greatly because he believes the president lied to the grand jury. But he says in the context in which he lied, I do not believe it's a high crime or misdemeanor. I respect that reasoning. I disagree with it. No Democrat on this committee has ever suggested that the president's conduct was acceptable. Let the record reflect that. Whatever differences we've had, there has been nobody from this committee on the Democratic side ever suggested that what the president did was appropriate or was okay. I think they deserve to have that said. If this is a vote of conscience, and I believe it is, it's going to come down to a Republican conscience versus a Democratic conscience. And I don't know how to characterize that. I don't know what that means. I would suggest that one is not better than the other. I would suggest that there's a very unique nature about this case that we need to look at long after this case is over, and only time will tell who got it right. One thing has guided me more than anything else, and I've really had to struggle. Do you want to impeach a president when it comes down just to the Lewinsky events? I live in a district that finds the conduct unacceptable, and they quite frankly do not want Bill Clinton to be their president. They never have. As a district, we've never voted for Bill Clinton. And the misleading and all the things that the Democratic members condemn as being unacceptable, people in my district find not only to be unacceptable, but inconsistent with national leadership. I am proud of my district. I respect those in my district who disagree with the majority, but the majority in the 3rd District of South Carolina believes that the conduct is inconsistent with national leadership. I have tried to take a middle position. I like politics, but I love the law. The law has been something I chose to do to make a living. When you politicize the law, you're putting the country at risk. My father and Mr. Hyde made sure that we could come together and disagree, that the first person to ever go to college from their family, like Lindsey Graham, could one day wind up in Congress. If we had lost that war, that would have been impossible. So I've tried to take a tone here that the law has to win out over politics. And the easy thing for me to have done from day one is to come up here and rant and rave, because that would have played well, because people do not like the president. I have asked the president on numerous occasions to reconcile himself with the law. I never meant for him to have to humiliate himself. The standard that Governor Weld has set to reconcile himself with the law, quite frankly, is stronger than I've ever wanted. I do not want to take money out of his pocket. I do not want to humiliate him in front of his family or daughter. I merely want him to have the character and the courage to come forward and admit to criminal wrongdoing, that he violated his oath, that he engaged witnesses in a proper way. I was willing to make sure, if I could in any fashion, that the whole affair would end then, that 2 years from now he need not have to face prosecution. I think the chances of that are almost zero. That's all I ever wanted from my president. I'm about to vote. I have yet to receive that.
Five pieces for
I don't know if I will ever get it. Bill Clinton's fate, ladies and gentlemen, my lady is in Bill Clinton's hands. The biggest enemy of Bill Clinton,
and finally, lady
just like with all of us, is Bill Clinton. God knows he has many enemies. God knows he's a polarizing figure. God only knows what's in his heart. I'm having to judge Bill Clinton based on evidence. And I would like to speak a few minutes to what I believe is the unshakable, undeniable truth. And much of it is about sex. This idea that the President of the United States, when he testified in Paula Jones's deposition, a lady who brought a case against him for sexual harassment, that he gave testimony that was legally accurate is a total falsehood. The idea that the definition of sex did not include oral sex and they did not ask the right questions, and if they did, he would have told the truth, offends me. This idea of what sex meant came up after this blue dress, in my opinion. The reason I say that is that on January the 17th, when he was asked to testify about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, he knew she had provided an affidavit denying any improper relationship of any kind whatsoever. He believed himself to be covered. He did not know of the tapes. Whether you like the tapes or not, he did not know of them, and without them, he would have lied with Monica Lewinsky to the prejudice of a citizen who was suing him for conduct, if true, should be enough to impeach him. We shall never know what happened in that room in Arkansas, or that hotel room. Two people know, and God knows. Why I believe the definition of sex as being propounded by the president to this very day is a lie is based on the conduct he exhibited after the deposition. On January the 17th, he would have us to believe they did not ask the right question, and the definition excluded oral sex. I would suggest to you that's a fabricated tale. That on January the 24th, we have a talking point paper from the White House telling people how to respond about the allegations against the president. And one of those questions was, does sexual relations include oral sex? The answer was yes.
The gentleman's time has expired. Without objection, so ordered.
Thank you. I'm taught in 30-second sound bites so long, I've never had this much time. Thank you very much. I can't believe 10 minutes went by so quick. What I believe is that his press accounts to Mr. Lair and to roll call indicate that in proper relationships, there was no artificial definition. This is, oral sex is not included. I believe that's a falsehood. That's a fraud. I believe that he knew Ms. Linsky's affidavit was false, and that when the discussion with Mr. Bennett came up in the deposition, he was following intently what happened, and that he was not surprised, and that he did, in fact, lie to the grand jury on numerous occasions. Should he be impeached very quickly? The hardest decision I think I will ever make. Knowing that the president lied to the grand jury about sex, I still believe that every president of the United States, regardless of the matter they're called to testify about before a grand jury, should testify truthfully, and if they don't, they should be subject to losing their job. I believe that about Bill Clinton. I believe that about the next president. If it had been a Republican, I would still believe that. I would hope that if a Republican president had done all this, that some of us had went over and told him you need to leave office. I understand the dilemma that all of us are in about that. His fate is in his own hands. Right quickly, Mr. Chairman, 30 years from now, they're going to judge what we've done and how partisan it's been and whether or not this made any sense. I just want you to know, as you look back and look at these tapes and find out what we're doing, there's one member of Congress, there's a lot of us here, believe the president has lied to us to this very day, that we can't reconcile ourselves with that, that it was in a lawsuit with an average everyday citizen, legal rights at stake, and the most chilling of all things to me was the episode after he left the deposition. He told Mr. Blumenthal that the Monica Lewinsky was basically coming on to him. He had to fight her off. He told Betty Curry she wanted to have sex with me and I couldn't do that. The most chilling thing was, for a period of time, the president was setting stories in motion that were lies. Those stories found themselves in the press to attack a young lady who could potentially be a witness against him. To me, that is very much like Watergate. That shows character inconsistent with being president, and every member of Congress should look at that episode and decide, is this truly about sex? Is Bill Clinton doing the right thing by continuing to make us have to pursue this, have to prove to a legal certainty he lied? The president's fate is in his own hands. Mr. President, you have one more chance. Don't bite your lip. Reconcile yourself with the law. I yield back.
I
well beyond my time.
I thank the gentleman.